Yeah, baby. Welcome back to Dr. Drill's Making Motivation podcast, where it is our mission to honor interesting and authentic people by telling their stories. In the process, we hope to inform the viewer. We hope to rile you up, put a smile on your face, and a little fire under your ass, my friends. Check it out. Today, I've got a good friend of mine, Patrick McKernan. And Pat, as he will share with you, he is a former Marine. He is a Vietnam vet, and he is a career law enforcement officer. And he's a fierce motivator. How are you doing this morning, Pat?
Good morning, Drill. How are you, sir?
I'm awesome, brother. I'm really honored to have you on this podcast. A little background. How do I know Pat? Many years ago, doing the Dr. Drill program, I had two young ladies who were participants and real friggin' hard chargers. And we have many, many stories and did a lot of tremendous workouts together and a lot of laughs along the way. But I learned very, very early on in our friendship that their dad was a Marine and he was a local police officer. And eventually we were introduced. And thereafter, we kept in pretty decent touch. I remember you stopping by the office a couple times, Pat. Somewhere there's a picture. It was like, I don't know if you remember this, but it was like a copy of an image that had a Marine on it. And it's some memorabilia, something motivating. Anyway, you're a former Marine. I'm a former Marine. We're friggin' motivators. You got a story to tell, brother, and I aim to let you tell it. So let's start from the beginning. Where are you from?
I'm originally from Norristown, Pennsylvania. I lived on the Cherry Street in Norristown. And before you say ask any other questions, the reason why I was smiling when you were playing that song, "We Gotta Get Out of This Place," it was a bunch of Marines in a slop shoot, we called, which is a bar. Nobody knows what that is. And we were drinking 3.2 beer, near beer, we called it. 3.2% alcohol, that's all we had. And can you imagine where it was a metal shed with screening around it. And the bar was plywood with two barrels on it. About 20 Marines singing, "We got to get out of this place." That's why I was smiling at the beginning.
You're drinking near beer.
Brought back memories.
Where was that?
Vietnam.
Okay.
In Vietnam. We were drinking. It's called 3.2. That's all it was.
How much do you have to drink?
That's what you had to drink. And you had to drink a lot to try to get a little buzz on.
Hanging out with your brothers.
Oh, yeah. Many times.
Yeah. That's awesome. So tell me.
Anyway, getting back to where I was originally from. From Norristown, Pennsylvania. I lived on Cherry Street in Norristown. Born and raised there. And my father was a Norristown police officer, detective sergeant also for Norristown Police. I come from a long line of family members. Started with my grandfather, Andrew J. McKernan, who was a sergeant in Norristown Police Department. He was born in 1890, passed away in 1931. He was on duty on a motorcycle with the sidecars. And from what my investigation proved, he was hit by a hit-and-run driver. Grandpa was thrown to the air, and when he landed on a curb and ruptured his kidneys. As a result of that injury, Grandpa suffered for 3 years and later died in his bed at the age of 41 years of age. So he was a fallen police officer in Norristown. Being honored from Montgomery County, he'll be on the plaque when it gets re-erected back at the Montgomery County Courthouse. Then my father was a detective sergeant in Norristown, and he was also a Marine in World War II. So I'm very proud about that. Then came my brother. He was an officer in West Norton Police Department, then later became the chief of police in Collegeville. I then became a police officer in Whippane Township. And my uncle Joe Doherty was also a Norristown police officer. And one of my cousins, Lawler, from Upper Marion Police Department. So we have a long line of Irish cops.
little bit of a legacy there. Yeah.
That's awesome.
I'm going to remove myself from the screen so that everybody can see your pop there just for one split second there.
Okay.
I want you to tell us a little bit about him.
That's my father. Picture of my dad. As I said, he was a World War II Marine veteran, and he was my inspiration. And when the day I joined the Marines, I first worked at a warehouse in King of Prussia, and Vietnam War started. And at the age of 19, I went down to the recruiter, which is maybe half a block away from the Norristown Police Department, Sergeant Roberts, and I signed the papers. And I can remember walking up to Dad's police department, walking up the steps, and walked in, and Dad's detective office was on the right. And back then he wore the Stetson hat with the all curled up, little 38 on his hip, and he was typing on a typewriter with two fingers, which is kind of funny. And he looked up and he said, "Yo, Pat, what are you doing here?" I said, "Dad, there's something I got to talk to you about." He said, "Yeah, what's on your mind?" I said, "Dad, I just joined the Marine Corps." And the words that came out of my father's mouth, I never heard before. A lot of effing idiot, you MFs, you stupid, blah, 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 on, on. And it was so loud that a couple of police officers ran over and said, "Jack, are you okay?" He goes, "I'll be fine." And with that, Dad got up and came over and hugged me and said, "I love you." So that's when I joined the Marines and left for boot camp several months later. And I was in the 1st Marines in Parris Island, 1966. Graduated from the Marine Corps, Parris Island, as a top shooter. I was a top shooter on the rifle range.
What was the rifle?
The M14.
Nice.
The iron sight.
Should we have gotten rid of that or what, man?
No, that was the best weapon I ever carried my entire life. It was, you could throw it in the mud, throw it in whatever you want to do with it. It fired. Rust, I don't care what was wrong with that rifle. I mean, I carried several over in Vietnam. That was my choice, the M14.
Yeah.
After leaving Parris Island, I went for infantry training down at Camp Geiger. And spent time down there in what they called the John Wayne course. Believe it or not, we trained with the M1 rifle for the John Wayne course.
Awesome.
They had a simulated jungle with booby traps and pop-up targets with live ammunition. So I went through that course, which is pretty interesting. We also got a chance to fire a grenade from the M1 at tanks, learn training how to throw grenades, live grenades, and so forth and so on.
How does that work? Not to cut you off there, Pat. How does that work with the? I've seen that before, probably in the movies, where the M1 firing a grenade.
They had grenades you could put on a rifle with a different round you put in, and it would actually fire a grenade not that far. I'd say probably maybe 200-300 feet. Pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And we were aiming at tanks, trucks, and so forth and so on. Cool. Funny story about being at Geiger. We were living in the Hooches,
yeah,
from World War II. And I guess it was maybe 1 o'clock in the morning. Everybody was in their racks sleeping. And the next thing I know, concussion grenades were thrown in and smoke grenades were thrown in. And I heard a machine gun going off with blanks. Hopefully it was blanks. And talk about waking up to that. And the next thing I know, all I heard was, "Who the hell stole our recon flag?" The recon was right next to us. One of our idiots stole their flag.
Oh, shit.
And you talk about a waking pucker moment. Smoke, concussion grenades, and a machine gun going off.
Oh, man.
The flag was returned within about 2 minutes.
I guess so.
That was a funny story about that. That was a wake up moment.
Yeah, old core stuff there, man.
Old core stuff. So I finished my infantry training in Camp Geiger, and I got pretty friendly with one of the instructors for the grenades. And jokingly, I said, "Yo, any chance I have take a grenade with me to go home with? She said, what are you out of your mind? I said, well, you know, I like to fool around with it. So yeah, I'll tell you what, let me defuse them, which he did. And put the pin, I put the cap in the bottom of it again. And I had two hand grenades. I came home to on leave. And I was talking to my dad one day, and we had a little backyard in the back. Hey, Dad, could you come out here for a second? I want to show you something. And I knew the grenade was defused, but we still had the firing pin in it. And he said, hey, what do you got? I said, check this out. I pulled a hand grenade out of my back pocket, pulled the pin, threw it in the backyard. Dad ran like hell, cursing like hell, into the, back into the house.
Trying to give him flashbacks.
The firing pin went off and came out again screaming, oh, you could have gave me a freaking heart attack, you idiot. That was kind of a funny story. You know, actually, believe it or not, I still have one of the hand grenades. I don't know why you painted it, but there it is with a hole in the bottom.
Nice.
Dad painted it. Hand grenades are brought home.
Dad painted it?
Huh?
Who painted it?
Dad. I don't know why he painted it, but that's one of the grenades we carried in Nam.
Nice.
So, a little memento there.
Very, very nice. A little show and tell.
After leaving the Geiger, I told you I went home. And my first duty base was El Toro, California. I was assigned to G2 Intelligence out there. That was an air base, one of the largest air bases in the United States. And I applied several times to go to Vietnam. I finally was accepted. So I went back home and flew over to Okinawa from Oki, went to Vietnam and C-130.
Nice.
And remember that day in particular, because when the ramp went down, I remember walking off the back of the ramp, and it was hot. And I mean, it was hot.
Oof.
And the only thing I still remember to this day is to my left were like five body bags next to me. Also, artillery's going off. And I'm like, everybody's walking around like, this is it. This is the real McCoy. Found out that was our artillery going off in the mountains.
Okay.
So I signed in, and lunchtime came around, and you can relate to this. It's called Starch Utilities.
Yeah.
Meat and breast. So I'm sitting in the tent trying to, in the background, being by myself because I don't want anybody to bother me. But prior to going in there, I saw a deuce and a half, which is, it's a truck.
Yeah.
Four Marines jumping off the back with flak jackets, helmets, rifles, machine guns, all that stuff. And didn't pay too much attention to it. So as I'm sitting there eating, I had my head down. And the next thing I know, there was a Marine standing next to me with dirty boots, 45 on his hip, and a flak jacket. And you're a Marine. How long have you been in country? I went, oh, God, here we go. He's going to bust my shoes. I looked up. It was my best buddy from Norristown, Pennsylvania, I grew up with. Hung around with Tommy Mahal.
Wow.
Never forget that as long as I live. It was Tommy. And he was part of that. He was part of those guys that jumped off the deuce and a half. They just come in to get refreshed and so forth and so on. So we went out, had a couple beers that night, and it was the monsoon season. It was kind of wet. And so anyway, that was my first and last time I ever saw Tommy. He went back out into the fields. And from what I heard later, I was talking to my mom and dad on the comm center, which is the radio, that he left Vietnam before I did. Never got scratched.
Okay.
But coming home, he was on a ship and sitting on a pair of steps. There was a Navy guy above him and dropped a wrench, hit Tommy in the head, and knocked him out and cut his head open. He never got a scratch in Vietnam, but on the way home.
A squid hits him with a friggin' wrench.
Squid hit him with a wrench.
On purpose or what? No.
No, it was an accident. He was up top doing something. And the funny thing about it is, as I said, I communicated one phone call home where I was in the tent and they had the old crank radios.
Yeah.
And like I said, I was in intelligence, but I had a captain sitting right next to me that I worked under. He was in intelligence. So you had to watch what you're saying and different things because the enemy could listen in.
Right.
And I remember it was the radio went from Vietnam to Okinawa, from Okinawa to Hawaii, Hawaii to California, and then from California, it was a landline to Norristown. Wow. What you had to remember was every time you talked on a radio, you had to say over. So everybody on the radio would be able to click and cut the conversation off to California.
Wow.
So I remember the phone call went through to my father. Must have woken him up at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I could hear him answer the phone and said, "Mr. McKernan, we have a collect call from California from your son." And my father, the typical Irish guy, he goes, "What the hell is he doing in California? He's in Vietnam. Sir, you can't say something like that." Well, you have to say over. He goes, "Over what? What the hell are you talking about?" So that was a little bit of a funny story in Vietnam.
That's great. It was great that you could communicate. You know, you could talk to people at home, you know?
That was the first and only time I ever got a chance to call mom and dad.
Other than that, letters?
Letters. That was the only way I could communicate with through letters.
Yeah. Mail call.
Mail call.
Absolutely. That feels good, doesn't it? When, I'm only serving in peacetime, but I remember on ship, you know, you get a mail call comes in, feels really good when you get a bunch of mail, and feels really like shit if you ain't got any coming in, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, it may be late, old news, but it's letters. The good thing about us, it didn't cost us a cent to send a letter back home.
Right.
It was free.
That's awesome.
It was free.
That's awesome, man. So your intelligence in Vietnam, is that MOS that you chose, or they just put you where they wanted you?
They put me in. I was actually originally started out as an 0311, as you know, infantry.
Yeah.
And then when I got to Vietnam and I signed in, they said to me, "Oh, by the way, you might not even be staying here in Vietnam. You might be going to Japan." I got all excited. Of course, then they changed it and they said, "Now you're staying here." And they changed my MOS to an 0211. Which okay. is intelligence. Funny thing about the Marine Corps, just so everybody can tell you this, I first joined boot camp, they classified my blood as O negative, O positive, O positive. Okay. Before I went to Vietnam, they classified my blood again, O negative. Left Vietnam, came home, they checked my blood again, AB positive.
Oh, geez.
Three different blood types.
Wow, what's up with that?
That was how quick things got done to get you over there and get back. And the only thing I remember is they said to me, "Thank God you didn't need a blood transfusion over there because you would have died."
What did you wind up being?
AB positive.
Okay.
It's so like a three sets of dog tags.
Oh, wow, man.
In fact, my daughter, Chrissy,
yeah,
she has one of them.
Awesome.
Which the one? Old ones. The old ones.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, she's a motivator, man. That's good. That's just like her to honor you by wearing those or yeah. carrying them. Yeah. So you're in Vietnam, man. What's that like? It's hot. You said you talked about the 3.2 beers.
Yeah, the 3.2 beers. Actually, I have a photograph here. If you can see it, I'm gonna wait.
There you go.
All right, they were French quarters, as you well know. The French were in Vietnam for us.
Yeah.
They were what they lived in. That's one of the buildings that I lived in Da Nang, which is right next to a village called Dog Patch. We didn't have any running water, at least for once a week. And when we did have running water for showers, it was brown water.
Oh, geez.
I had brown water. So we took a shower once a week. That was about the extent of it. One of the things my father always sent me was Kool-Aid that I could put in my canteen to mix it with the water.
What is Kool-Aid?
Kool-Aid is a liquid. They sell them in little packages. You pour it in the water and it gives you different flavors.
Oh yeah. 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 That goes a long way, right? Little,
yeah.
I'm thinking like, the MREs when I was in, they had the little drink mix or whatever. So that was
same thing. Yeah. Same thing.
Nice. Yeah, give you a little taste of home. What was your favorite flavor?
I can't remember. Probably cherry. I don't know. I would give them some to the other guys too that taste made the water taste a little bit better.
Yeah. So what was the landscape like, Pat? What was, I mean, what was the base that you were serving on?
The base I served on was Da Nang, which is, like I say, right out the dog patch, right below the 1st Marine Division Hill. And we were surrounded by the 1st Marine Division, and also the largest air base was Da Nang, which was occupied by the Air Force and also the Navy. Our base was probably within a quarter of a mile of the air base. RPX, the 1st Marine Division on top of the hill, was the first place I went to. They really didn't carry too much. Slim Jims, popcorn, basically that was about the extent of it. But if you went to the Air Force PX, oh, it was like going to Costco, because the Air Force had everything. In fact, they even had air-conditioned barracks over there, which is unbelievable.
Man.
Unbelievable. Air-conditioned barracks.
Not too shabby. Yeah, that's messed up, dude. That's not good for morale, right? Having these different services have different treatment. I mean, I know that's the Marine Corps has got this, like, you know, this reputation of doing so much with so little. But yes. I don't know. Maybe you think that the air conditioning would have made you guys nasty?
Oh, school? A little bit, especially living in French quarters with mud walls and, you know, those hot roofs and no air conditioning, just a screen in the window.
Oh, how about the head? What is that? Where was that? I always see
the head. It's a funny story about the head. Our head was where the showers were. And as I said, we had no running water. So it was basically just a big hole. And they emptied it every so often. And there's one evening when I first got there, I had dysentery and I couldn't wear clothes for a couple of days. Oof. Because if I did, I would just mess my clothing up all the time.
Yeah.
And we got hit one night, and I can remember I was on the shitter.
Yeah.
And I remember everybody's running around going crazy. And one of the guys are like, yo, we're getting hit. I said, dude, I don't care. I can't get off this shitter. I had to stay there. So finally, I did run back and throw some clothes on and flak jack and helmet and rifle and go out to do what I had to do.
Duty calls, man.
Duty calls, but I had to do what I had to do at the time.
Big time. So now, I'm looking at our little outline that I created. Is that the story that the first night first day you arrived in Nam? I mean, you already mentioned that you're greeting your buddy.
Yes, Tom.
And then that's that story. So you get boots on the ground there. You see those guys unloading from the 5 tons, and you run into Tom. What else was the scene like?
Well, it was hard to take. As I said, seeing the body bags.
Yeah.
Told me this is for real. I mean, this is for real. This is a real McCoy. I reported my duty station. And the first night there, we deployed to the China Beach. And night time. And I was at a bunker out there. Never been out there before in my entire life. Never been in that kind of scenario before in my entire life. And I was with another Marine. And we took turns. And he took the first watch. And I guess whatever time of the morning he came in and woke me up on a cot. And our bunker was enclosed. It was all dark. And I've never seen rats that big. And I mean rats. Yes. Unbelievable. So he came in and woke me up. And I took the post. And it was kind of quiet. So I went and sat on the edge of the bunker, the sandbags. As I'm sitting there, I heard it. What the hell was that? I didn't pay too much attention to it. And I heard it again to my right. And I looked down, and there's sand coming out of the sandbags.
Oof.
And I'm looking. The next thing I heard is another shot go by my head. So I ran back into the... Woke him up, and his reply was, "Are you hit?" I said, no, he goes, go back out. So that was my first shot.
Damn.
That was my first time I ever been shot at. 19-year-old kid from Norristown.
Just small arms fire.
Small arms fire. They called him One Shot Charlie. He was in the village, and at night he would take one shots trying to hit somebody. So okay. That was his nickname, One Shot Charlie.
So he was in a nearby. The village was part of your
Particular village was no. Like I said, my first deployment that evening in South China, I had to get in the deuce and a half. I guess it's about a mile from our base. So
yeah, I was a student. One Shot Charlie was that's a good thing he wasn't so accurate.
No, but I remember that movie, Stay Away from the Oil Cans.
They start sprouting, freaking holes and shit. Yeah. So you got
baptism by fire, as they say.
What is it?
Baptism by fire.
Baptism by fire. Seriously, man. So I understand you have some show and tells from NOM. That might be interesting. Yeah. Let's go through them, man.
Well, let me reach over and grab something
here. Yeah.
I'm going to show you something. This is a piece of shrapnel, if you can see it or not.
Yeah.
It weighs 20, 25 pounds. And this came from one of our rocket attacks. Our base was the first base to be hit by rockets. And it was February 67. And I was in the bunker, and it was a direct hit on our ammo dump at the airbase. And I just remember a flash because it was a direct hit to the ammo dump. And I heard a loud thud, maybe half inch above my head.
Oh, geez.
A couple other Marines in the bunker with me. And things happened, as you all know. Anyway, we repelled the attack. And I turned around to look to see what that thug was when things kind of calmed down. And that's when I found this piece of shrapnel. And I pulled it out of the sandbag as a memento. And as things kind of calmed down, eventually I showed it to my Colonel Dodenhoff, who was flew the F-4 Phantom.
Okay.
And I was thinking from a rocket. And he says, no, that's one of our own 500-pound bombs. It was a direct hit on the ammo dump. So I wouldn't be sitting here right now, or any of your friends, Michelle, would not be here also, if this thing hit me.
No kidding. So what hit you? Friendly fire?
It was a direct hit from the ammo dump. The rocket attack.
Ah, okay.
A rocket attack. We found their location, and they manned out of dirt, piles of dirt, to get the elevation of the rockets to shoot to our base. Through our intelligence, we later found out that it was from kids in the village next to us were plotting the base with kites, windage, and elevations. Okay. So no more flying kites over our area.
Serious. So yeah. Then the ammo dump goes kaboom.
Bingo.
And that was one of your five. So that must have been a big ass explosion.
Yeah, like a little bit. Like I said, all I can remember is just seeing a light, flash of light, and being thrown, back. I can already remember that. And that was this another time when we had a rocket attack, the same scenario, and had a large flash. And thrown through the air, and I was buried under debris, concrete. And I don't know how long I was there. And I remember being pulled out from several other Marines. And I can remember my first comment was, is everybody okay? So that was another time that a rocket attack against our base. We are on the Guinness Book of Record, believe it or not, for the first time any base ever got hit by rockets.
The Guinness.
Actually, I got a picture of me holding one. It was a dud.
Really?
Yeah, I got a picture of me. I don't have it here now, but it's a picture of me holding one of the rockets. They defused it. And I was holding, 19-year-old kid. So.
Wow, dude. So how did, when stuff like this happens, rocket attacks and you're in a combat environment, how did you, those are scary instances, I mean, you're a young man, obviously you signed up for this stuff. Now, let me ask you this. This is just a quick aside. Draft or you enlisted of your own? Because your dad was a World War II vet, all this history of service, legacy of service that you're carrying on. So, how do you deal with that when the shit's hitting the fan and rockets are coming in and blowing up your ammo dump? How do you get through the day?
I got some hard moments, I can be honest with you. When the situation occurs, your training kicks in from the Marine Corps. It really kicks in a lot. Your adrenaline gets pumped. And you really don't think too much. One of the things you have to try to avoid is what they call tunnel vision. You can't focus on one particular thing. You have to envision the entire thing. Your adrenaline kicks in, but also sometimes fear kicks in. And there was one particular moment when we got hit, and I was living in the French quarters at the time. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, I think it was. And I was running to my post, and as I was running, there was a Marine lying on the ground in the fetal position, and I thought he was shot, and I ran to him, and I grabbed him, and I started to drag him, but he was alive, and he wouldn't move. He was frozen in that position, and I'm receiving gunfire, rounds are going around, I can hear him. And finally, I hollered a derogatory comment to him, and he got angry, and he jumped up and started running towards me. So I ran. I ran to my post. But as I was running to my post, I forget how long it was, maybe about 30 yards away that we had to defend the exterior. I remember jumping into the bunker. There were several other Marines there at that time. And I remember jumping in and turning around to get back up. And I remember a large flash from a rocket that hit close to us. And I could see him coming in towards me with a K-bar, which is what I have here also. I can show you.
Yeah.
It's a knife, if I can find it. This is what they call a K-bar. This is what I carried in Vietnam.
The very one?
Huh?
The very K-bar?
I'm sorry?
This is the exact K-bar?
This is the exact K-bar, because there's a story behind that also. I remember him saying, I'll effing kill you.
This is the guy that you just called an expletive or whatever?
Yes.
He's running after you with a K-bar?
Yes. And he's lunging towards me. And thank God, there are two or three other Marines are already in there. They jumped on a guy and subdued him, brought him down, took his K-bar off him, took his rifle off him, and pointed their guns at him. Eventually, he calmed down, and he stayed there. And believe it or not, he's actually part of our firefight.
You broke his, so if I can assume here, you broke his, he was having a moment.
Correct.
He was in.
And it happens. It happens.
Yeah. It's fight or flight shit, fight or flight. So he's curled up in the fetal, you're like, hey, come on, let's go, expletive. And that breaks his kind of trance that he's in, right? His fight or flight, enough to go get to try to take the frustrations out on you. So he was just having, he lost his shit.
Correct.
So correct. What happened to him?
I don't know. He left the bunker after the situation occurred, and I did see him occasionally on the base, occasionally. But yeah. We never made contact after that. I never approached him about it, and he never approached me about it.
You like you said, it happens, right? We all have these moments, and we have to find a way to deal. I mean, in a way, he should thank you, right? Because you could have been, you could have saved his life, you know, something like that.
Good possibility, because like I said, the rounds are very close, the rounds, very yeah. close.
So then humor, there's something called gallows humor, right? You know, and that's one of the things, and I know you're very professional here, but one of the things that Marines and military personnel I found can speak fluent is profanity. So, you know, that's kind of like, I always felt like that was our way to fight back against the hard times, you know, using that vernacular, the language of our people, if you will, was effing this and effing that and shit. And, mm-hmm. and I'm sure you could probably teach me some things, maybe in Vietnamese. But yeah, so gallows humor. You got any experience? How do you guys deal with that? You guys ever deal with hard times by cutting loose, playing pranks on each other?
Yes and no. As I said, we always had to be alert on our base. We come in from the situations, and we wouldn't talk too much about it. We would kind of hold things inside. I guess our way of letting loose is going to the slop chute, as I said, and drinking a near beer and letting loose and things like that. And I think it was near beer only because they didn't want to get it so inebriated that we couldn't keep our senses together. And what really made us really angry, very angry, was the officers' bar. They had the good stuff.
Of course they did, yeah.
They had the hard liquor. We didn't have the hard liquor. Story with regarding the hard liquor is... one of the Marines, the 1st Marine Division, you know, they had the black market in the villages. And they would sell stuff from there. And you bought a bottle of VO. And he drank it. And found out he passed away. And what they did in the village, they somehow were able to cut the bottom of the bottle off. And they filled it with formaldehyde, with the alcohol.
Really?
And somehow put it back on. So when you drank it, apparently lost his life.
That's terrible, man.
I know.
Poisoning, yeah.
There's a lot of stuff in the black market you can really buy, but I never really got involved in that too much. The only thing I really bought was a pair of sandals that they made out of truck tires. And inner tubes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm sure you heard about that. And I bought those. And what really made me angry was when I came back from Vietnam, I brought them with me and to Okinawa. And I don't know who he was, but some Marine stole a lot of my artifacts, were brought back. My mosquito net, the sandals, which would have lasted a long time, things like that. I guess he never served combat, but he stole the stuff out of our barracks.
That's messed up, man. I know. You know, one of my, I mentioned this in a previous podcast, one of my favorite isms is that the notion that in my time, anyway, you could take your wallet and whatever, your personal items, put them right in the middle of your rack in the squad bay and nobody should be able to touch it. Correct. That's a great ideal. And I think a lot, like vast majority of Marines will uphold that level of integrity, but there's some shitbirds too, man.
There's some shitbirds, but it never happened to me in Vietnam. Everybody respected each place you're at. Everybody respected. It wasn't until I got back to Oki, when I came back from Nam, that I guess it was someone who never served over there. I don't know. And took the stuff from there. And that's what it is.
Filthy bugger.
But getting back to this K-bar is a funny story behind it, because we were not allowed to take anything out of there. Nothing military. They checked us high and low. And I knew that. So a buddy of mine was Captain Lucas. He also flew the F-4 Phantom. And his plane, he was going to fly back to Oki. He was done. And I said, hey, Captain, I need a favor. He said, what's that? I said, can you take my K-bar home with me? and ship it home to Norristown? Yeah, I'll take it. So he did. He put on the plane with him, flew to Phantom back to Oki. I could be how longer. I got a letter from my father. He had a box delivered to his house with my K-bar in it.
Oh, nice.
What the hell is this knife? So that's how I got this back.
That's awesome.
Captain Lucas took it back home for me.
It's good to know Captain Lucas.
Yes, very well. It's a good friend of mine.
So, you know, Pat, you said, so intelligence, what was the mechanics of that MOS? What was your daily duties and responsibilities like?
As an MOS, we would go out on patrol, capture Viet Cong, bring them back for interrogation, so forth and so on. Or go up in helicopters, so forth. We'd also obtain intelligence from villagers about things that were going on. Myself and Captain Lee went out one day with our Jeep to a village. Supposedly there was a guy there who was going to supply us information on a future attack that was going to be coming. And for how far we drove, maybe a couple miles, we could found the village. And we're going into the village. And I can remember it was people walking everywhere. So this captain's looking for this particular guy. And we got to the end of the village, so he couldn't see him. So we turned around, we're coming back. And as we're coming back to the village was empty. Literally nobody around. And all he said was, get the hell out of here. Floor it fast. I didn't understand what he was meaning. So I did what he told me to do. I hit the gas pedal. We were set up. We started receiving incoming fire through the village. A couple of rounds hit the Jeep. Never hit us. So it was a setup by someone who said he had information.
Now, what do you have? You have like a 50 cal or a machine gun of any kind?
No, I carried an M14, and I have a picture here. Like I said, I carried the M14. This is a Jeep that I drove. Let's see here. That's the Jeep right there with my 14 next to it.
Nice.
And I also carried the grease gun, if you know what that is. The grease gun is what they made in World War II. Carried a 45.
Yeah.
You know, it was about so long.
Kind of like a Tommy gun?
Nah, it's not a Tommy gun. It's not even as big as a Tommy gun. They're made very cheaply at a tin, and it carried 45 clip underneath it.
Okay.
And it's called the grease gun. I carried that over now to an intelligence. But the 14 was my go-to all the time.
Okay.
It could be rusty, mud. I don't care what it was.
Oh, freaking great, dude. So you roll into that village, and that's good armament and stuff like that. But are you accompanied by other?
No, just the two of us.
Okay.
Just the two of us.
So really kind of you work in small unit stuff.
Very, except for going out into the fields and, you know, capturing VC and so forth and so on.
Yeah.
VC is Viet Cong. So.
Yeah. Now, how often did you run into them?
Every couple of weeks, we go out with, you know, a couple of guys, a couple of platoons, and search and rescue and stuff like that, and bring them back.
So you would attach onto a,
yes,
like a infantry unit?
Yes.
You'd be there, and then from there,
yes,
extract with, you'd work within that unit?
Yes. And then, you know, also we receive information, top secret information, and we would plot, a lot of guys would plot bombing missions. North Vietnam photographs, and also artillery and so forth. And that's one of the other things that we do when we went back.
It's awesome, dude.
And burn pits, a lot of burn pits. I did a lot of burn pits. So I was
surprised
at that too, huh?
What's that for?
Well, burn pits is, as you well know, is burning human waste.
Yeah.
Okay. And also I was in charge of burning and destroying all our top secret information. I got a picture of me somewhere standing in front of one, but I don't have that here.
Yeah. So now, well, I'm just thinking about this as a straight infantryman, Pat. You, the information that you were privy to then, you know, a lot of times as a grunt, we were like waiting on word. Hey, when it comes down the chain of command, you're a good guy to know, I guess, because you have would have some good intelligence. Did you brief the patrols that were going out and stuff like that? Or
no, not for going out for missions like that. No, absolutely not. We weren't allowed to put any kind of information out. We just tell them certain locations that we'd be going to is what we were. It's fact, the only thing we would actually say.
Now, but if you were a guy on my base or whatever, and I come back in, I'd be hitting you up for information. Hey, Pat, you got any friggin'? We got 3.2, man. We're in the friggin' swap chute. Tell me what's going on, Pat. Are we gonna, you know, we're going on this mission over here? Any of that stuff?
Not too much, really. Can't say that at all. And be honest with you, before I left Vietnam, December '67, we had information of an attack, a huge attack that was going to be planned. And didn't know what it was, didn't have no idea what it was, but it was going to be a major turnaround. And luckily, I did leave. And I think it was, a month later, Tet occurred, the Tet Offensive in January. So several weeks after I left, Tet Offensive occurred.
Yeah. And what did you think about that?
I got lucky. I was lucky to get out of Vietnam at that time.
How long have you spent there?
Huh?
How long have you spent there, Pat?
13 months. Other military branches, 12. Some are Marines, got to be 13.
Yeah.
Got to be 13. In fact, I want to show you more show and tell.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a thing called short timer. I'm sure you heard that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yes, sir.
So I remember the day I left Vietnam, and this is what, if you can see this or not, a buddy of mine drew this with me, about me. It's supposedly me running to the plane. And on there, it says, "You'll never make it, Pat."
Let's bring that into the camera. I want to see a closer look.
Okay. And in one hand, I have my orders to leave. And I think in the other hand, I have a briefcase. And right below there, it says, you'll never make it, Pat.
That's a terrible thing to say.
I know. And behind there is, I don't know if you carry, did these in, or not, but that's my, everybody had these. When you're leaving on a certain amount of time, it's a short timer's calendar.
Yeah.
You would color in each day until you got to the very last day. And it's one of the body parts of a woman that you'd carry to the very last day. Attached there also is a cartoon I carried out of Stars and Stripes. And it's something that says, "I'm so short, I can't even carry a long conversation." You guys in the bunker.
Nice.
And then over here, my father sent me a card for St. Patty's Day. And I cut that out, and below it says, "Goodbye, Vietnam." And I have my name and my best buddy over there, Steve, shaking hands.
That's awesome, dude.
That's something we short timers calendar.
Very special. Like, yes. Yeah, we used to say, like, you know, 25 days in a wake up sort of stuff.
In fact, funny you said wake up, my last night. You have Marines are. They don't care. You're there at the last second.
Yeah. You
put me out on patrol my last night.
That's messed up.
Talk about it. Every click, every noise. I can't believe they did that to me.
Yeah, it's messed up. That's almost like some other guys I was talking to talk about. It's almost like a superstition. Like, you know, I'm getting close to, you're cool. You're easy peasy. It's like business as usual. Up until, you know, when you start getting short and you're like, okay, you're not really going to put me out on that patrol, are you? My last friggin' night there, they put you out on a patrol.
Yeah, a little bit. In fact, I can relate that to when I was a police officer, my last night on patrol, my last day there, I was instructed to go home. Go home. Take off. We don't want any, you know, this is your last night. Well, typical jarhead, I stayed on patrol. In fact, there was a domestic call of a man with a knife on Fifth Street.
Yeah.
And I was the first car to respond. And I remember tackling the guy down, taking the knife off and putting the cuffs on. And the OIC today came over and said, "What the hell did I tell you? Don't get involved in anything."
You couldn't help yourself.
Yeah. Go home and be safe.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, there's the, it's a Marineism, you know, always, we like the 13 months and the, you know, the Marine Corps work ethic and the stop at nothing sort of philosophy. But isn't that funny how, you know, 30 years prior or 40 years prior, you know, you were, I don't know, obviously not happy about being sent on that last patrol, but on your last patrol as a lawman, you felt compelled to do that. That was deliberate, right? That was.
It was, yeah, it was my decision to stay.
Yeah. That's the right thing to do, man. That's the right, that was the right thing to do. That's a proud moment for you and a fitting end to your service in the police force, my man. Who, you mentioned a couple of your good buddies. Who are your best buddies while you're serving in Nam?
Steve, and I can't think of his last name right now. Krudash, Steve K. Krudash, the guy I mentioned on his air. Steve and I are very, very close over there, very close. It was a bond. It was a friendship. I kind of wish I reached out to him again, but I really didn't. We had a lot of good moments, a lot of bad moments, funny moments in particular. In fact, funny moment was, remember walking down a dirt trail, and it was Marines that came up in front of us. And all of a sudden, I started seeing him moving to the sides. What the hell are you doing? I was brand new. And next thing I know, I seen this little twister, dirt, coming up, little mini twisters. And I didn't pay too much attention to it. And I figured, well, it's going to go right by me. Hey, it went right by me, flipped me up in the air into a ditch.
Really?
They were laughing like hell. And the next thing I know, it was just kind of like swirling down the trail. Didn't pay too much attention to it. That was a kind of a funny moment, that being Nam, being, you know, newbie. What do you call it, the effing new guy?
Yeah.
And the other time, because I wanted to be cool as a Marine, so I put the C-Rack can opener around my neck and my chain with my dog tags. And I had, it was hot, had the shirt off and stuff like that. And Marine was there for a period of time. He walked up and he goes, "Oh, Marine, how long have you been in country?" And I forget how long I was in country. And he says, with that, he takes his hand and slaps my chest. And the C-Rack can opener was, apparently they opened up sometimes, and he punctured a hole in my chest with the C-Rack.
Really?
Yeah. And he said, "I bet you'll never wear that again around your neck." I said, "Nope."
This is a couple, there's a couple pictures I'm sharing here for the viewer. This is Pat in his boot camp. And then check this out. There's not a smile, a little bit of a smile on your face there, brother.
Yeah, that was, we just came from a mission. I came in from one of our missions.
What are you holding in your right hand there?
The M14.
Okay. Just trying to make that out there. And what was it like? What was the mission like on that particular day?
As I said earlier, going out with the other Marines, different units from the 1st Marine Division, and capturing and taking people out of the villages and interrogating them, so forth and so on. And then if they're a VC and so forth, we had information at VC, we take them out of the village. Of course, there's a lot of VC living in the villages. And at night is when they would attack us. So we get information of who they were and bring them back.
How often was that the case that they?
We go out maybe several times a week, maybe once a week, maybe every 2 weeks. It depends on when we get information about different things.
Yeah. It's pretty incredible, man. Pretty incredible. What is your last memory you had before you ran for that plane? And obviously you did make it. What was the last what was that day like? So you went out on that patrol, and do you remember the emotions you felt or the people that you last saw?
Well, Steve stayed back. We got there right after me. And there was a Sergeant Hilfinger also that I was got very, very, very close to. And he was like my mentor. He was one of the guys I really looked up to quite a bit. He was awesome. He was a Marine, true blue and true. Everything. He taught me a lot, taught me quite a bit over there. The day I left, I was scared, very scared. But I can remember getting on the plane. And when we lifted, I swear to God, it had to be, I don't know how many guys were on the plane at that particular time, but I can still remember the screaming was so loud once we hit the air that I swear to God, we lifted that plane 200 feet up in the air. It was so loud.
Just cheers of joy?
Oh, unbelievable. It was totally unbelievable compared to when I went to Vietnam. It was total silence. You could hear a pin drop on the plane because you were going into war. Big difference. Big, big difference. Funny story, because when I did get back to Okinawa,
yeah,
a couple of guys, we went to an actual bar, slop shoot back over there. It was in the evening, and we were walking down the road. And next thing we know, we hear gunfire everywhere. I mean, not where we're at, but we heard gunfire. And immediately instincts, we all went to a ditch. And I think after a few moments, we all looked at each other and one of them said, wait a minute, hold on a second. We're in Okinawa. We're not in Vietnam. Found out they're doing night training and they didn't tell anybody up on the hills. So that's a funny story.
Yeah, because you were hyper-vigilant coming back from Vietnam, right, where the rear
end was on, right? Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Any little click, any little move, any things like that, you were ready. You never became complacent. You couldn't be complacent in your job over there. Can't even be complacent as your police officer because things happened, as you well know, within a millimeter of a second.
Yeah.
Yeah. You do become complacent. There's a period of time, I'm sure other veterans can tell you the same thing, that when you're in a situation like that, you come to a point in your life where you say, I don't care anymore. I'm tired of worrying about it, which I did.
Right. And what is that? I mean, that's like I'm just thinking as a doctor and an anatomy professor, that's like, and kind of adaptation to stress, like, right, you're just like, all right, I care, because you're so stressed out about the day to day and every moment, what, waiting for the next shoe to drop and or the next round of break blast into your sandbag or the next friggin' ammo or rocket attack, that what you just, you become so accustomed to that, you just say, the hell with it, I'm gonna deal with it, I'm driving myself crazy, I'm just gonna,
if you don't, it's going to really tear you down big time.
You have to adapt.
You know, it's, you just come to the point where I'm tired of thinking about it.
Yeah. So now you said, you know, you spend the rest of your life as a police officer, so that I'm sure persisted, but to this day, are there isms or there you know, are there things that will remind you or you're wary of or trigger you about those days? And
there's moments, especially as a police officer, you go back, but then it all goes back to your training, the Marine Corps.
Yes.
The training that they gave you. You have to detach yourself from the situation at that particular time. You can't be part of that situation. You have to be detached and to take control of that particular situation. Over in Vietnam, almost the same scenario. You can't get that tunnel vision. You have to be able to look everywhere when it happens. And your mind plays funny tricks in situations over there. And again, another funny story, after a situation occurred one evening, I can remember looking out and were dropping flares and so forth and so on. It was all bright and illuminated out there. And I just remember hollering to my guy, "Yo, we're being attacked. They're coming in on elephants." And everybody kept looking at me, "The elephants, yeah." I swear to this day that I saw elephants with Viet Cong coming in to attack our base. No elephants out there.
Hallucination?
Hallucination.
Mind playing tricks on you, sort of
thing. Yeah, yeah. That's a funny story.
Did they have you cycle under a psychological eval?
No, they just bust my shoes quite a bit.
Said, like, I'm thinking about the tone in which you described the event earlier about the gentleman who was in the fetal position. You said it happens.
It happens.
That's something, these things, the hallucinations, the fog of war, they call it, right? You know, how these stressful environments will play tricks on us and make us stress us the hell out. So, okay, so you're on that flight. Imagine you on that flight with all these other servicemen, Marines, and contrast starkly from the arrival where you could hear a pin drop. Everybody's in an uproar, and they're excited to be getting out of Vietnam. And then you come back to Oki. You rotate back to the States at some point, I'm sure. And how long do you stay in after that, Pat?
Well, back when Vietnam first started, the Marine Corps started a program that if you signed up for only 2 years, not four, they had a two-year program, you had to go to Vietnam. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. And that's exactly what occurred. So when I came back from Vietnam, I had 92 days left in my service. And they also had a program that if you came back with 90 days or left, you would be discharged. I had 92. So my duty station was Little Creek, Virginia. They stuck me on a Navy base that had 20 Marines on the base. And they put me in a mail room that was the size of a bathroom. So I go in the morning, there may be 10 or 15 pieces of mail. I get in the Jeep, drive around the base, deliver the mail, and go back and sit in the office all day until the afternoon, and go back out, pick up the mail, and go back to the barracks. For 92 days I did that.
Not a bad gig.
Not a bad gig, but I had no idea what a mailman was. None at all. That's what they made me, a mailman.
So. Yeah, it's the other worst gigs than that, man. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. But you think you leave me go in 92 days, but I had 90. You know, I didn't hit 90.
Yeah. So then you're out.
You one more thing, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I want to see it, man.
This goes back to Vietnam. I'm pretty proud of this. We come in for patrol one day, particular day. And when you first get in country, we had white T-shirts over in the States. And so I remember taking my shirt off, and one of the guys from across me, "Yo, can I draw something on your shirt?" And I said, "Yeah, okay." So now it's a little yellow right now and kind of skinny. But I don't know if you can see it or not. I'm trying to find it. Here it is right here. He drew this on my T-shirt, if you can see it.
Yeah.
It's a Marine. And in his right hand, can you see his right hand?
Yeah, maybe reposition it a little bit so I can see that lower figure there.
Is that where he's holding a Viet Cong by the hair?
Pick it up a little bit. A little bit higher. Yeah.
Yeah, he drew that within a couple minutes.
That's pretty impressive, man. You had some artists in your midst over there.
Yeah, we have some artists in our midst. In fact, there's a picture in the museum in Vietnam. Oops. He actually drew that. Do I have it up, right side up?
Sorry.
Can you see it? Let me see here. Oop, I had it upside down.
A little bit higher. Oh, wow, man.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah. He's a pretty good artist.
What do you draw that on?
Well, that was a photograph that he drew, and it's hanging in a museum, in the Marine Corps Museum in Virginia.
That's amazing, Pat.
Yeah. So he was a pretty good artist, but I'm very proud of his t-shirt. A little yellow, a little skinny. I was maybe about 150 pounds when I came in now.
You could fit into that sucker right now. So that's awesome, dude. That's
and
awesome.
And like I said, I was in intelligence. This is pretty large, so I might just step back to show you this. This is some of the things that we had. There were identifications of the Arvin soldiers over there.
What's Arvin?
That's the Army Republic of Vietnam. They were supposed to be our allies over there. So this is what they look like over there. And then, of course, these are things in Vietnam. This is the enemy.
Wow.
Photograph of the enemy.
So now, if I was the enemy, I would dress up like an Arvin soldier. You ever see that?
It does happen. Absolutely. It does happen. It does happen quite a bit over there. So I don't know how other people feel, but we didn't have too much respect for the Arvin soldiers.
Okay.
Hardly any at all. Some are good. Don't get me wrong. But the majority of them, no.
Not committed.
Absolutely not.
Not disciplined.
You not trust them at all. Not trust them at all.
And yet you have to rely, I imagine you have to work with them a lot and rely on them for intelligence.
Yeah, they had a base right next to us.
Yeah, that's got to be pretty tense, huh?
Yeah, as I say, we disassociate ourselves from them at all. But you talk about the M14, whether you ever fired it or not, I don't know. But when I was in Nam is when he first came out with the M16. And history shows that they were not the best weapon, if you remember that.
Yeah.
So we were detailed to go out to the 1st Marine Division to get acclimated with the M16. So we had to turn our 14s in temporarily and then issue the M16. And they showed us how to operate and work it. And then they put us online. I guess it maybe 30, 40 Marines were online. They said, okay, guys, spray and pray into the jungles. And if it jams, raise your hand. So we did. We started spraying and pray, as they call it. I think that only lasted maybe 5 seconds. And it was total silence. And you look down the line, and all you see were hands raised in the air because they sucked.
Oh, really?
They were the worst weapon you could ever think about grabbing, you know, the M16s. So after a couple more times of doing that, when you went back, the armorer, you got the option, the M16 or the 14. Everybody, my buddies, all went right back to the 14. We never took them.
That makes sense to me, man.
Yeah. Oh, no. In fact, my buddy, Tommy Mahal, I talked to you about first day in Nam, he did have the 16 at a period of time. And he told me stories at the time that they jam, constantly jam. And that's exactly what happened to us. So.
Yeah. We can't have that out on an operation or something like that. Now, that's a favorite platform. Everybody loves the AR-15 mod. I know they've.
Oh, yeah. Now they've modified it quite a bit. Yes.
I know they've improved it quite a bit. Yeah. Still, I'm sure you'd rather carry your M14, huh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it had rust. Don't get me wrong. It had rust, but it worked. It worked. Yeah.
And higher, better caliber. Was that 7.62?
7.62, yeah.
Yeah. So, awesome. So, leave Vietnam, come home safe, do your time in the mailroom, and you get back to the block. So, it seems a logical extension that you would continue your service following in the footsteps of your grandfather and uncle and father?
Well, as I said, I worked in a warehouse called Thriftway Foods in King of Prussia, midnight shift for about a year and a half. And I was 21, 22 at the time. And as I said, my father at that time retired from the Norristown Police Department. And he said to me, he said, hey, one of my buddies, the chief in Whitping, Earl Kelly, there's an opening. You know, why don't you go up there and put your name in? I said, Dad, I'll put my name in. He said, well, yeah. He says, He said, you want a job that's going to be secure. And I said, what do you mean by that? He said, well, being a police officer is a secure job. Excuse my French, because there's always going to be an asshole.
That's true, man. There is always going to be an asshole. That's a fact.
So there I go. Went up, took the tests, did all of the above, and became my first department was with Payne Township Police Department.
And have you liked being a police officer to start?
Very beginning, brand new, fresh out of the box. I got trained at the Philadelphia Police Department, which is an eye-opener to be trained in Philadelphia. In fact, we had a lieutenant down there who did hand-to-hand combat. And if you ever asked to use the restroom in a class and you got excused and you're walking down a hallway, you had to look both ways everywhere because you never know when this lieutenant will pop out of nowhere and bring you down. And I mean bring you down. He said, you always got to know where you're at. He took me down one time by because I wasn't paying attention. He hit you to the floor fast.
Hey, practical training, real
time. That's Philly. That's Philly down there. You know, that's Philly. So, I started fresh as a police officer in Whippane Township. And I think I was on the street not even 3 months. And one of our guys got married. And I remember the chief said to me, you can work the streets by yourself. Now, I'm talking 13 square miles. And I'm brand new, 3 months out of the box. And it was a Saturday night, second shift. And I can remember sitting at the intersection right below the church where he got married at. And all my buddies are going by, cops are waving at me. I'm the only guy working. And I remember calling every police department next to me. Said, please, any calls I get, back me up because I have no idea what the hell to do.
And they did, I bet.
Oh, absolutely. We were like the Marines. It was a brotherhood amongst police officers. We may have our differences, but when things happen, you don't even think about it. You're there for each other's back.
That's wonderful. Is there a difference in your estimation between someone who former military and straight police?
Well, police officers are a little bit more relaxed than military, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Military has strict rules and regulations, SOPs. Police officers do. Back in my day, when I started in the 70s, we had rules and regulations, but nothing was down in writing. So it was a little bit different back then. Some of the weapons we carried, basically you can carry what you want to carry. Believe it or not, there's no standard weapon. One of our guys carried a 44 Magnum. 6.5-inch barrel, Dirty Harry. Myself, I carried a 357 Model 19, which some guys carried a 38. Some guys carried a 38 snub nose. I also, believe it or not, carried a 12-gauge sawed-off shotgun, Savage, double barrel.
Nice.
Yeah, 15-inch barrels.
Very nice.
It worked a few times for me. I can tell you that on the streets. It definitely worked a few times. Definitely. It stopped situations very quickly when they saw that sold-off shotgun.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a good selection, if I do say so myself. So you shared some stories here, some highlights about your time on the force. Let's do like a little hybrid of the good and bad. There was you delivered a baby?
Yes, it was a Sunday morning. 9:30 in the morning, and I was sitting at an ice cream parlor on Route 202 by the Altamos building, if you know where that round brick building in 202.
Yeah.
And it was quiet. Sunday mornings back then, it was very quiet. And for oxygen, I know, I look up, and there's a car stopped right in the middle of 202, and the guy's screaming at me, help, help, help. So I go over. I left the patrol car in the parking lot. And I go over and said, my wife's having the baby in the back seat of the car. So that was my first experience delivering a baby.
Oh my gosh.
First experience. And we didn't have handheld radios back then. So I had to run back to the patrol car and get on the radio and request an ambulance to respond to that location. We were taught in Philly Academy to cut the cords, but I didn't do that. I didn't cut the cord, and I just put the baby close to the mother and covered the baby up. And so that was my first experience delivering the baby. And ambulance came and took her to the hospital. So
that's awesome, dude. And did they name it the baby Patrick?
No, there's a funny story behind that too. When you said Patrick, in Lansdale Police Department, I stopped a young lady one morning for making an illegal left-hand turn at Main and Walnut, and pulled her over into the parking lot of the Rite Aid. And to make a long story short, she'd been drinking. She had been drinking, but she wasn't over the limit. And I was backed up by another police officer. And I said to the sergeant, look, she's very close to the limit. I said, do you mind if I just drive her home? Just drop her off and she'd come back and take the car the next day, which, yeah, no problem. It wasn't no big deal then, which I did. So I got done at 3:30 in the morning, and the officer who backed me up said, hey, you know that young lady you stopped? I said, yeah. He goes, would you mind if I give her a call? I said, I don't care. I'll give her a call. I think you want to go out with her. So I guess it was about a week later, I see the officer and we're talking. They go, I called her up and asked her out. And she goes, well, you know, she said, you're a good looking guy, but you're a little bit too much older than I am. Because I was older than this girl. She goes, hold on, you got the wrong police officer. And he told her who it was. She goes, okay. So they went out and they got married because of my car stop.
That's awesome, man.
And I went to the reception and they had me stand up and be recognized. That was the reason why the two got married. And then after she said that, she said, I'm going to ask another girl to stand up also at the same time, which she did. And she says, Pat, this is the girl I was out with that night. She was in front of me and you didn't get a chance to stop her. She's here also. She married a state trooper. And I want you to dance with her. Our first dance was with the girl who got away from me. Later, they had a baby, and they did name their baby. Their middle name was Patrick in honor of me.
Hey, man, it's a small world. It's you're part of their story.
Yeah, and they're still married, happily married, 20-some years later.
Oh, that's awesome, dude.
Yep.
That's great. So that's a good delivering babies and giving people a break and being part of their marital journey. What about the bad stuff, man?
Yeah, well, I had a few incidents as a police officer, some very, very, very close. One particular incident was I was with Payne Township. It was a Friday afternoon around 5 o'clock. There was two officers on duty. And as I said, we didn't have portable radios back then. So when you went home for dinner, you would sign off to the county radio. And the other officer went to the house. And I was out on the street, and I answered the call for a struck deer. I was down on Pendleton Bluebell Pike taking the call. When I got a radio message from the county radio to respond up on Route 73 above 202 to assist the other officer who was called out of his house by phone for a streaker. And streaking was real big back in the time. Back in the 70s, everybody streaked. Football games, baseball games, they run out buck naked, so forth and so on. Well, this guy, he's what we call a 4300 in the police department. It's someone who has a mental situation going on. And his first name was Lloyd, but Lloyd was extremely strong. I mean, he was ripped, very strong. And he was streaking up and down on Route 73. So I responded to the other officer and pulled my patrol car up on Route 73, got out. I was walking over to the officer's location, who was standing there talking to the guy's mother, leaning up against a shack. And as I walked past him, the officer's patrol car was in the driveway. And with that, Lloyd was in the home, and he came out, kicked the storm door, and came out with a shotgun, instantaneously fired directly at me. The round hit right past my legs and blew the headlights out of the patrol car. So I ran back to my car and got the shotgun, went to the opposite side of the shack, and I'm going across a field, and Lloyd saw me, and we had an exchange of gunfire. I can remember diving through the air and firing the shotgun at him, and he jumped down behind some hedges. Now, he had me pinned down in the field. And I hollered for the officer. I said, I know where he's at. He's behind the bushes. Fire into the bushes. Flush him out. So the officer fired. And, yeah, Lloyd jumped up. And as he jumped up, I jumped up myself. And he's running back into the house. I fired another round and hit the door. Blew the whole side of the door out. Just missed the guy. So he called for assistance. We didn't have SWAT team members back then. It was just other officers. So eventually these other officers arrived, and state police arrived, and the state trooper, he was a detective. And I knew the guy, and he got next to me, and we're trying to negotiate to him to come out of the house. And next thing I know, he starts hollering, "I want Birdie. I want Birdie." Everybody's looking around, who the hell is Birdie? I want to talk to Birdie. I knew who Birdie was. Birdie was one of our sergeants. And they nicknamed him Birdie from high school because he was won all kinds of awards as the fastest track guy in Norristown High School. He was nicknamed Birdie. So eventually the county radio got a hold of him. But by the time he got there, this trooper looked at me and said, "Look, let's take him out. So we did. We both jumped up and movie? Anyway, we kicked the door in. As we're kicking, we heard a loud blast. And we couldn't kick the door in all the way. And the reason why we couldn't kick the door in all the way is because he committed suicide. So everybody and their mother is running around, you know, so forth and so on. So I guess you want to call it experience. And I just kind of disassociated myself from the situation. It's kind of funny, but walked back to the patrol car, unloaded the shotgun, put it back in the rack, got in the car, drove down 73, crossed the, they had roadblocks, went past the roadblock and went to my friend's deli, Gene's Deli. Walked in, sat down, I had a cheesesteak hoagie and a cherry Coke. And Gene said, "What the hell is going on up the street?" I said, "Oh, streaker, you're streaking." Okay. I had dinner, got back in the car, drove to the roadblock, went back up, walked into the scene, crime scene. And the lieutenant looked at me and goes, "Hey, you got something I can write on?" I said, "Yeah, nobody missed me." Nobody missed me. So kind of a funny story where,
yeah, man,
you know, it was very close, the situation, very close.
The something comes to mind, Pat, and you kind of touched on this earlier, you know, you talk about leaning on your training and preparedness. You know, something that came to mind was immediate actions. When I was in the Corps, we would especially in the training, you know, boot camp and School of Infantry and all that stuff, it was all about immediate actions. If this happens, if that happens, what do you do? And so you descend to the level of your training, right? In situations correct. Like that.
Correct.
So how do you stay? I mean, you kind of answered it already, but how do you stay calm under fire, literally like that? How do you do it? Can you explain how?
I guess it's called an animal instinct. It's called survival. Is what kicks in. We all have that. But as I said to you earlier, there are situations where the situations makes you freeze, which happened to that one particular guy. That was basically the only time I really saw a situation like that. Everybody else, they reacted. They were Marines. They pushed forward. So a lot of my training did go in my police department. Absolutely. In fact, it's funny because when I was pinned down, there was a guy, his name is Kelly, and he had a police scanner, and he would go to calls, any kind of calls, and take pictures and made money that way by selling them the newspapers. And when I was pinned down until arrival came, Kelly only lived a short distance from there. I didn't know this, but he came as a photographer. And to my right, I heard click, click to my right. And right away, my instinct was somebody's cocking a gun, going to shoot. I immediately turned around with my gun. And next thing I know, I heard, "Pat, it's me. Don't shoot." He was taking pictures of me. And again, my Marine instinct, the picture he took was me lying deep flat on the ground with my feet flat in the Marine position that they taught us in boot camp. It's kind of funny about that. But one of the pictures that he did take, I was working second shift. Apparently he put it out there, and I was supposed to go to the shore the next day to see my future wife. She was down in Atlantic City. And if I got down there, I came down. She was down on the beach, and I'm walking down to say hello to her, and she looks at me, and she was mad. I mean, mad. I said, "Why are you so mad?" She said, "I don't believe you didn't call me." I said, "What?" She says, "I'm sitting on the beach, and there's a guy on the other side. He got a paper. It's called the Daily News. You know, it's a pretty big paper, and like a book."
Yeah.
He says, "And I look over, and on the front page is a picture of you with your shotgun."
Damn.
That he took. And she goes over and gets the paper, and she saw it was me, and she got angry because I didn't call her. Of course, it was a crazy situation that night. You know,
so yeah.
You didn't have cell phones and all that kind of stuff. But
all in the day's work, man.
All in the day's work. But later, Kelly called me, and apparently he got an award from the Associated Press for that photograph. Went to Harrisburg, he got an award. I think it was maybe 2 weeks later, I get a message. The secretary says, "Pat, you got a call from California. Some guy wants to talk to you in California." So I get on the phone. I told him who I was. He says, "Yeah, hey, is this Pat McKernan?" "Yes, it is." He says, "You served in the Marines?" "I said, I did it." "You were in Vietnam?" I said, "Yes, I was." "How the hell do you know all that information?" He said, "I served with you in Nam." And I said, and he told me his name. I forgot his name right now. I said, "Start telling me." I said, "Oh, then I remembered him, who he was." "Oh, my God." Yeah, blah, 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 blah. I said, "How the hell do you know I was here?" He said, "Well, he's the one who had to get my newspaper one morning." And I'm sit down at the table with my coffee, and I'd open it up, and I'm reading. And there's a picture of you, Officer McKernan, under fire. And look, he said, "He's a guy from California." So
that's awesome. That's great, dude.
Yeah.
You know, there's one more story I want to pick your brain about. It's on along the same lines, but in a civilian capacity. Well, a couple things I want to know. So a lot of your I imagine that a lot of your experience in law enforcement involves de-escalating tense situations. How would you do something like that? How do you approach a difficult situation, a difficult person, and you have to be calm and try to move the, you know, redirect whatever sort of animosity or a tense situation. Let's say it's an interpersonal thing, traffic stop or something. How do you accomplish that?
Well, one of the things we were trained is to not be part of the situation. So when you get into a situation, when you first enter, you are a neutral party. You can't be on one side or the other side. No matter what decision you make, one or the other is going to be upset, but you have to make a decision. You cannot be part of that, because once you become part of it, you're involved in it, and your emotions overtake your actions.
Right.
That's some of the things that when I was training officers in Lansdale, we'd have whatever case, many, many bar fights, stuff like that, and go crazy. And I would have them try to handle the situation to get, again, baptism by fire. Then I would see them becoming, losing it, and then getting involved or angry at this particular person. And that's when I would step in and take the person back and get them away from that situation. And then say, look, you can't be part of this. You have to be neutral. You have to, it's hard to explain. I was actually told one time by a very personal friend of mine that I have ice in my veins, that I have no feelings about different situations. You can't. And I've had some situations, young babies that I lost, I couldn't do nothing for. You wish you could do things for, but you're not part of it at that time, but it hits you. And it remains with you forever, all the time. It's hard. But then you have another situation where I think I told you earlier, where I had a young infant in Lansdale, choking victim. Mm-hmm. 2 months old. And she was blue when I got there. And the parents just screaming. And through my training, every year we got trained, I was able to save that baby. And when that baby started to cry, it was a moment. It was just a moment that I just handed the baby back to the mother. She just got released from Chops Hospital a week before that. And it was a moment that I remember walking to my patrol car, getting in, and I was shaking and crying. And I needed to talk to somebody. And I reached out to my daughter, Michelle, who you know very well. And she talked to me. And she made me feel better. It was a moment that I guess I can't say I was happy. Can't say I was sad. Or was I elated? I don't know. But to see that young child come back, that was a moment. That was a moment. That's something to always remember. I've had that moment. But I also had a moment where I got a call of a woman having a heart attack, and I responded to that location, brought her back. And ambulance came, took her out and all stuff. And it had to be a year later, my father-in-law at the time was with me in the car. We were somewhere, went in to get a cup of coffee for him and I. I go to Good Cat, check out. I think it was over in Chester County. And the guy looks at me, he goes, "Hey, aren't you a police officer?" And I'm looking at the guy with, "Oh God, here we go. Somebody stopped. Somebody arrested us." "Yeah, how'd you do that?" He said, "I thought I recognized you." He said, "You're the one that responded to my home for a woman having a heart attack." He said, "I want to thank you." He said, "It was my aunt who was visiting. She was a nun. He said, "I remember you bringing her back to life." He said, "I just want to say thank you, and coffee's on me."
That's
pretty cool. That was a nice moment. Nice moment.
Yes, nice it was.
Moment. Yeah.
That's very special, Pat.
Yeah, like I said, I had some good moments, and I've also had some bad moments. And the majority of my bad moments are overseas.
Yeah.
Overseas, things I saw and things I did. So, but anyway.
Yeah. My brother, I'm going to ask you a couple questions in closing here. What does Semper Fidelis mean to you?
Semper Fidelis, as you well know, is always faithful. But it's a family, it's a brotherhood of men and women now that stays with you your entire life. I don't care where you are or what you're doing. If you meet another Marine, it's like you met a family, one of your relatives, someone that you've known for ages, but you never knew. It's a strange situation. I can give you an incident when I was trying to come back from where I was coming back from a base, and we were stuck at an airport trying to get on that airplane, myself and a couple other Marines. It was called standby. And we were stuck wherever we were stuck. And we were trying to get on the plane. And a gentleman behind me, this guy, hey, Marines, trying to get on the plane. And we all said, yes, sir, absolutely. He says, I'm a colonel in the Marine Corps. He says, come with me. And we had no idea who this guy was. And he takes us to a VIP room. We go into this room. The colonel made a few phone calls. And he says, you'll have a plane to take you to Philadelphia. I said, excuse me? He goes, you'll have a plane. And the colonel, like you said, Marines stick together. Remember him saying that? Marines stick together. Next thing we know, shuttle bus took us out to a plane. There was three Marines on the entire plane. He had a plane pull in. He was the owner of a company. It was his private plane. Flew to Philadelphia.
That's outstanding, man.
Yes. Marines stick together. Marines stick together.
Pat, on that note, I think we covered all the ground that we needed to, bud. Your story of service in the United States Marine Corps, as a veteran of Vietnam and as a veteran law officer, and now you're retired. How you doing in retirement?
Love it.
Yeah?
Love it. You know, do I miss the job? I don't miss the stuff that goes on, but I do miss the guys I work with. In fact, I think it was the second weekend when I was retired, they got hit with a major snowstorm in Lansdale, big time, close to 18 inches of snow. And my phone was lit up by all kinds of text messages, calling all kinds of names. You know, you're this, you're that, you can't handle a job. And pictures of the snow on top of the patrol cars, you know. I remember it was like 11 o'clock at night, and I texted back. I said, guess what? I ain't even taken a bath all day or brushed my teeth. I don't care. I'm retired.
So you're enjoying life.
I'm enjoying life and enjoying the moment.
Well deserved, my brother. And thank you for your service.
Thank you, sir. Also, Semper Fi.
Semper Fi to you. You have a great day, my brother.
Thank you for all.
Can't wait to share with this podcast with the girls.
Absolutely. Thank you.